I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Last year, the city of Oakland recorded its lowest number of homicides in almost two decades. Their annual trend of reducing fatal shootings stands in contrast to other cities in America. Today, how Kansas City could benefit by replicating Oakland's Operation Ceasefire to reduce gun violence. We'll examine the case study that offers a blueprint and find out what lessons it offers for a safer community. Then, the divide between the young and elderly is expanding as more social and technological changes are emerging. Learn how relationships across generations can prevent loneliness and isolation issues in society. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. If it happened in Oakland, the thinking goes, why can't it happen in Kansas City? Since 2012, Oakland has cut its annual shootings and homicides nearly in half. In fact, by 2018, Oakland recorded its lowest number of homicides in almost two decades. Of course, all this stands in marked contrast to what's happened in Kansas City and many other major American towns. So what was Oakland's magic formula? Truth be told, Kansas City may already be headed in something of the same direction. With us today is Mike McLively. He's a senior staff attorney and urban gun violence initiative director from the Giffords Law Center. He joins us this morning from the University of California at Berkeley. Mike, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
The program that Oakland employed to curtail violence was called Oakland Ceasefire. What is Oakland Ceasefire?
Right. So Oakland Ceasefire is the name of Oakland's citywide gun violence prevention strategy. And it really has five core components that I'll describe really quickly. One is doing an in-depth problem analysis to really understand what's driving violence in the city. And it turns out it's a very small group of people who are at highest risk to be involved with violence.
Hey, and before how are those violence-prone individuals identified by the police? How do they do that?
Yeah, so that involves taking a look back at shootings that have happened over the last few years and analyzing them, doing interviews with officers, with community members. And really, there's a number of risk factors, the highest of which is actually being shot or having someone in your immediate social circle being shot. And really, one of the amazing sort of takeaways from this problem analysis was the city of Oakland, for many years, decades, in fact, didn't really have a good grasp on what was driving violence. It was believed that it was a large group of young people who were having disputes over drugs.
And it wasn't, right?
Exactly. This problem analysis showed that the average age of a perpetrator and victim was actually closer to 30. And so a lot of the services and strategies the city had in place were designed to really not get to the right population. And that population of high-risk individuals was much smaller than previously believed.
So how
less
big
than
was
point,
it?
Yeah, it was 400 individuals at any given time for a city of, you know, just over 400,000 people. So pretty comparable in size to Kansas City, actually.
Yeah, what's interesting about that to me is if the number is just 400, it seems like that offers a little dose of hope there that you can corral the problem if you're only talking about intense problems with that few a number.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the major takeaways from our report for other cities. And we see that pattern of a very small number of people being involved with the vast majority of shootings in city after city. So that's not unique to Oakland. That's the case around the country. And it really does offer hope because instead of this very diffuse problem that's nebulous and hard to address, you have a very concrete and small population that if you can wrap your arms around that population, provide them social services, and where necessary, really work on improving the homicide solve rate, which in many of our cities is way too low. That can move the needle in just a few years, which is incredible.
Let's go back to other components of Oakland Ceasefire. Component two, Mike, respectful in-person communications. What is that talking about?
Right. So once we've established who is most likely to be involved with violence, the next step is actually communicating with those individuals. And there's two ways that the strategy does this. One is called call-ins, where a group of individuals up to 20 are actually brought in to meet with the strategy partner. So this is a partnership of law enforcement officials, community members, and social service providers who essentially convey a message of, you know, we know you're headed down this path. We want to see you alive and free and out of prison, and we want to see you and help you make a change. And so, you know, here are the social services that are available to you, and that conversation is facilitated. And then there's also a message from law enforcement that we are taking serious violence very seriously. And if, you know, the next time there is a shooting, there will absolutely be swift and sure response.
I was going to say the message is conveyed that the violence is going to stop, right?
Exactly. The message is the community is sick and tired of the violence. We want it to stop. And that needs to happen. And that message is conveyed, you know, not just from law enforcement, but from community members, oftentimes mothers who have lost sons to violence. So this is a very powerful message that comes across because it's coming from within the community.
Component number three, relationship-based social services. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is perhaps the most important element, which is, you know, if we're expecting the people to make changes, we have to create infrastructure and systems for that to happen. And there's a lot of great evidence out there showing that relationship-based intervention is the best way to make that happen. And so in Oakland, there's a whole network of community-based organizations that's funded actually by a ballot initiative called Measure Z. So there's millions of public dollars going to support the system. And you've got, just as an example, there's a program that provides hospital-based violence intervention. And so people who are shot are at very high risk of being shot again. As many as 40% of those individuals are back in the emergency room in just a few years. And so this is a social service that's set up to intervene, to build a relationship with someone who's in the hospital room recovering from an injury. And we see that rate of injury recidivism drop down to very small percentages for people who are getting long-term services like that.
Another component here, Mike, a focus on improving police-community relationships. I gather that's because so many members of the public here in Kansas City, I assume out in Oakland, don't really trust the police that much.
Yeah, absolutely. And in many, many cities, we see, you know, day-to-day shootings are most disproportionately concentrated in communities of color and in neighborhoods where there have been historic tensions between police and the community. And that really does a number of things. One is it makes the community less likely to cooperate with law enforcement. It makes shootings and homicides harder to solve. And that sort of drives the cycle of retaliatory violence when it looks like the state and the police are either unable or unwilling to solve these crimes. And so it's incredibly important. And the Oakland ceasefire strategy is intentionally designed to help build back that trust between police and community. And there have been a number of reforms put in place in Oakland that have led to an increase of the homicide solve rate from less than 30% in 2012 up to as high as 70% just a year or two ago. So we've seen major changes at a time when use of force incidents and complaints against the department are also going down.
I gather trying to regain that trust isn't something that can happen overnight. This is a process, right?
Absolutely. It is a years-long process that really should never be considered done. And there's been, you know, department-wide training on implicit bias and procedural justice. And anyone you'll talk to in Oakland will say that process is not nearly done and it will take years. But there are very encouraging steps or signs that show us that there can be improvements in a short period of time, but it is an ongoing work.
Is there any one key ingredient to improving that those relationships and regaining trust? Because I get the sense that Kansas City has tried all kinds of things, and you don't get the sense that it's changing all that much.
From looking at Oakland, I think buy-in from the community and engagement with the community is probably the number one ingredient here. I mean, this can't be something that just comes from the law enforcement department to say, you know, we're going to make some changes. The community has to be involved. And in Oakland, where it did not succeed in years prior, that's what happened, where community just wasn't involved. In Oakland, community members have actually been involved with training the police on the history of police and community relationships in the city, which has made a big difference. And just a long-term commitment to have those partners working together over time. There are no quick fixes here. Like, this won't be solved in a month or two. And so that long-term commitment is really important as well.
Okay, the fifth and final component of Oakland ceasefire, partnership-based performance management. That sounds like heavy-duty jargon there. What does that mean?
I mean, really what this means is this partnership is intentional and it's managed very well. So the strategy actually had a full-time and also the resources in place to do this work, right? So Oakland ceasefire had a full-time program director that's helping to bring these different stakeholders to the table. And this includes, by the way, you know, the mayor, high-ranking officers in the police department, members of the faith community, the social service provider network I mentioned, who are coming together on a very regular basis to discuss shootings, to discuss their group response. Because if you have this partnership, you have different options, right? You can intervene in a dispute that might be growing between two rival groups. You can also work on solving outstanding homicides in a better way. So that really is just talking about intentional getting these groups together to make sure the city as a whole is moving in the right direction.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about the declining violence rate in Oakland, California, and the steps that community has taken to drive that decrease, and wondering why, what some lessons might be that Kansas City can learn from this. We're visiting with Mike McLively, a senior staff attorney with the Urban Gun Violence Initiative. He's the director of that for the Giffords Law Center. You know, I'm listening to you describe all this, and if the chief of police of Kansas City, Missouri was sitting here in the studio with me, Mike, I think he'd probably be thinking to himself and even saying, hey, you know, we've tried a lot of these things. We are in the process of working with many of these different initiatives that you just outlined. Why wouldn't we be enjoying the same success here?
Well, I think part of it, and I haven't taken a look at this yet for the city of Kansas City, but I think, you know, you have to look at funding. And one of the things that is very unique about Oakland is since all the way back in 2004, they've passed a series of ballot initiatives that provide, at this point, $20 million a year for a city that's about the same size as Kansas City to, it's about 50-50 to the police department and to community-based groups to do this work. And that's combined with some state-level funding streams that exist in California that I'm not sure if they exist in Missouri. I doubt that they do. Mm-hmm. And some federal funding as well. And so Oakland's really given and devoted the resources to this work. I think there's sort of a myth out there that you can make changes without resources in place and see results. And that's just not the case. So, I mean, the first thing I would look at in Kansas City is, are there dedicated long-term resources to getting these key stakeholders moving on the same direction?
Are other cities having the same success with the Oakland model, Mike?
A number of cities are. On the smaller side of things, the city of New Haven in Connecticut has seen an enormous drop in gun homicides. They were in the 40s for a number of years, are down to fewer than 10 homicides now, so that's a huge reduction. On the larger side, cities like New York and Los Angeles are employing similar strategies and, again, funding this work at very high levels, both at the city level and at the state level, which is a really important component of this, and have seen tremendous drops in gun violence in recent years.
If our listeners want to join our conversation with questions for Mike about the success that Oakland has enjoyed, our number 816-235-2888, where you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. How big of a drop in violence has Oakland experienced?
It's been a large drop, and it's really important to point out that it's not just been in the homicide numbers, the vast majority of which are carried out with a gun, as they are in Kansas City, but also non-fatal shootings, which tend to get ignored a little bit more. Right. But those numbers went from the non-fatal shootings, there were more than 500, close to 600 in 2012, and that's down to the low 200s now. So we've seen a 50% drop in non-fatal shootings and a 50% drop in homicides, which is a very impressive reduction in violence in a short period of time.
Hey, have you spent time in Oakland watching the police do this?
I have. I live in Oakland, and so I've sort of had a front row seat to this.
I'm just wondering when, you know, there are these moments when police bring in, say, 15, 20 people who are viewed as being prone to violence. You know, how do they react to the message that the authorities and the community gives them? And do you have a sense? It clearly seems to be sinking in. Why? What's your sense of that?
Yeah, I think, again, the real key here is that the message is coming not just from law enforcement, but from community members, and that there's a real, genuine and robust offer of social services, right? So this isn't just the police coming in and saying, we think you're a bad person and we're going to be catching you soon. This is the community saying, you're a part of our community. We know you've been engaged in violence, but we know that you can change. We care about you. And, you know, when a mother stands up, and I've been to these meetings and seen this in person, and talks about losing her son, you can see the look on the attendees' faces, and it sort of changes. And there's this moment where they realize, you know, this is real. And the fact that there are social services there really makes a big difference. So this isn't just a, you know, wagging the finger and then walking away. This is a commitment to engage with these high-risk individuals for a long period of time.
I'm also struck by the fact that voters in Oakland adopted all of this back in the early part of the century. This has been in place and has been in the implementation phase for, you know, 15 years or so. And the program didn't see a lot of success right away. Why was that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, right, Measure Y, which provided funding for this back in 2004, it was very important, but it took a while to evolve. And I think it goes back to that problem analysis that we were talking about. That didn't actually happen until 2012, 2013. And so for a number of years, Oakland was, again, directing its services towards this young population, people under the age of 18, that it turns out weren't really involved in the majority of shootings. And so it took a while to evolve how those different strategies were put in place. And that's why it's important that this is a long-term commitment. And I think looking at our report, cities can hopefully bypass some of those, you know, missteps that the city of Oakland made and just get straight to the success. So there's a lot of learning that Oakland did. But that's why these can't just be one-year initiatives that then go away. They have to be in place for a longer period of time to get it right.
You know, this notion that the number of people prone to violence in Oakland was far smaller than people thought, and the idea that they were older by maybe a decade or so than a lot of police and a lot of law enforcement authorities expected. Are other communities seeing the same thing? Is that a trend or is that just unique to Oakland?
No, I think that's a trend around the country. I mean, we've seen reports from city after city showing that's generally a population less than 1% of the city that drives the vast majority of shootings. And yeah, there are a lot of important policy implications for that understanding that, you know, an investment in intervening with that population can have a very large impact in rates of violence in a very short period of time.
Again, I'm reaching here, but it also strikes me as a hopeful sign that this group is a little bit older, because in theory, they're a little more mature. Maybe they're a little more likely to respond to requests for change than a young person who's 15, 18 years old.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think things really change when these guys have kids and all of a sudden there's another generation that's involved. And so that's an important thing that can be leveraged and that will make them a little more open to change. The issue is a lot of our cities are not set up to provide services to that population. Once you pass the age of 18, there's not a whole lot in place. And so that's an important lesson from Oakland, is dedicating these resources to make sure there are services to work directly with that slightly older population.
I'm wondering if a city can take, you know, just a part of what Operation Ceasefire is doing and implement that and then be successful in lowering violence.
I think there are individual components that are all important and that could certainly make a difference, but that really you see the most success when these are implemented in concert, right? So a city could have a hospital-based violence intervention program. I would expect that to make a difference. But if they're the only show in town and that's the only response, that's just not going to be enough because there are just so many facets to this issue.
I was also wondering about these night walks that Oakland's community organizations engage in, actually hitting the streets in the evening. These are community members who go out. Can you describe what night walks are and what do members of the community do when they're out walking the streets?
Yeah, sure. So night walks are a way for Oakland community members to engage with the strategy. There are many ways in which that happens, and we detail that in the report. But really, it's a way for community members to get out into neighborhoods of Oakland, especially East and West Oakland, that have high rates of violence, and show their support for the community, show their engagement with the issue. And really, the idea is to be out on the street in large numbers to show that the community really cares about these neighborhoods, and then to engage with people who are out at those times, and this is generally in the evening time, to engage with them, to find out if they need services or help. And really, it's just a way of showing visible support that the community wants this to change, and that's helped keep Oakland's political leaders engaged on this issue and accountable as well.
Like, how many folks in an evening might go out? Do you have any sense of that, Mike, or
The average is around a dozen, and it's been as many as 100. It sort of depends on what's been happening locally and nationally in terms of these issues.
We have a tweet here from Lynn who's wondering. She says, hey, very good discussion, but doesn't California provide more gun control options than Missouri? And doesn't that wind up helping Oakland?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do think that is a factor, but it's really important to point out everything that's in our report that Oakland is doing is outside of the context of gun safety laws, which I recognize in Missouri is not necessarily a politically viable option at this point. But there haven't been any really significant changes in Oakland in terms of gun safety laws since we started seeing these changes. Those had been adopted in the years prior. And so, yes, it definitely helps that Oakland is in California, which has some of the strongest gun safety laws in the country. And there are actually no gun dealers at this point in the city of Oakland. And yet there's a lot that cities can do outside of regulating guns that can help make an immediate impact. So I think that's important to underscore.
But still, you're saying that the gun control and the lack of it here in Missouri is definitely an issue.
That is absolutely a part of the equation, no doubt. I mean, easy access to guns definitely helps fuel this problem. And so, you know, Missouri, we give a grade, Giffords Law Center, to all the states every year on the strength or weakness of their gun laws. Missouri is a state that consistently gets an F, so there is much more that it could do. The problem is for a lot of cities, if you're talking about Kansas City, there's preemption laws in most states, including Missouri, that basically say the city can't do its own regulations of guns. That has to be done at the state level.
Right.
And so most cities have their hands tied when it comes to regulating guns in any kind of meaningful way. And that's why we think it's really important that cities look to these other strategies that, you know, address this problem head on in terms of why is someone picking up a gun and working with those individuals human to human, because they really can't at this moment enact the kind of gun safety laws at the local level that would make a big difference.
But if Mike McLively could wave his magic wand, you would recommend some sort of gun control out here in a city like Kansas City or St. Louis where the violence rates are so sky high.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of policies out there that we recommend that would help without, you know, violating Second Amendment rights. And so one of the things California has is a gun violence restraining order, which allows someone who's at risk to be temporarily disarmed by a court for a short period of time. You know, universal background checks, a very basic policy that's supported by a huge number of Americans, just to make sure that it's not so easy for a prohibited person to go and purchase a firearm in a private sale. Things like that would certainly help.
I'm wondering if veteran residents of Oakland actually have come to appreciate the change. How is it noticeable? Are they enjoying their city more? Have you seen the fruits of this massive effort here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a sense that we're making a lot of progress on this issue. I also think, you know, there's still last year 68 homicides, which is 68 too many, and that might be a 50% reduction. We're moving in the right direction. But in the neighborhoods, especially in deep East Oakland and some pockets of West Oakland, where there continue to be too many shootings, there's a feeling of, well, this is great, but we need to make sure we keep this going and that the city stays committed to it. And so, yes, there's definitely a sense of progress, but it's definitely not mission accomplished. This is great, and we need to keep going.
Just maybe a final thing, and I hope I'm not getting down in the weeds too much here, but here in Kansas City, we have an organization called Aim for Peace that sort of views the homicide and the violence problem as a public health concern. And they have folks who go out into the communities, and they're called violence interrupters. They try to go where there's tension brewing and sort of diffuse things before the guns start firing. Do you know much about that kind of approach, and does it make sense?
Yeah, and that's actually exactly what Oakland is doing as part of the strategy and part of the social services is violence interrupters and street outreach work. And so Oakland has done a great job of making sure there is funding for those organizations and a whole network where they're doing peer-to-peer learning and making sure they're doing best practices. But yeah, that work and addressing the issue as a public health issue is a critical component of what happened in Oakland. I know Aim for Peace is doing that work in Kansas City, and that's fantastic. And I think it's a question of looking at the resources that are available for that work, making sure they're getting what they need to, you know, professionalize this work, make sure people are being paid a living wage to do this often dangerous work, but incredibly important work. And yes, that is a critical component of getting our cities to turn around on this.
So it sounds like Kansas City is doing a lot of the right things. And the question, the important question you're raising, Mike, is about funding. And is Kansas City adequately funding many of its violence prevention efforts to the degree that it needs to have the kind of impact required?
Yeah, adequately funding and adequately organizing and coordinating. That's a big lesson from Oakland, is that if these things operate in their individual silos, they're much less effective than when they're all working together in concerted effort.
Well, this problem obviously endures here, and we're just desperate to get answers. And I appreciate having a good conversation with you, Mike, about all this. Again, that's Mike McLively, Senior Staff Attorney and Urban Gun Violence Initiative Director at the Giffords Law Center. He joins us this morning from the University of California at Berkeley. Mike, thanks for the good conversation. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Steve.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about this idea that people of different age groups don't really talk to each other. Why is that? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we learned about one of the nation's oldest social service centers for Latinos, and it's right here in Kansas City. Hear about the Guadalupe Center's century-long history at kcur.org/up-to-date. Next week on the program, hear why the Kansas City Council is bringing trash collection services in-house. We'll ask if prosecutors have too much power in the justice system, and we'll meet a former First Lady of Kansas City who was barred from City Hall. Her name is Gloria Squitiro. That's all next week on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, six generations of Americans are now living in this country. Too bad we don't hang out with each other. Why is that? Why do people, generally speaking, interact mostly with people their own age? The idea of a 50-year-old talking to a 20-year-old, I mean really talking, is a fairly rare phenomenon. Chaim Herring tackles this dilemma in a new book, Connecting Generations, Bridging the Boomer, Gen X, and Millennial Divide. He joins us now from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio. Chaim, good morning. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Good morning.
Why is this an issue? I mean, some people might be thinking, so what? Why should this matter?
Because social isolation rates have really been on the rise, and we used to associate that with those who were elderly. What we've seen is that those who are really suffering from social isolation, having fewer friends, is occurring increasingly with younger generations. So we all have a stake in reconnecting, because there are dividends that come through intergenerational friendships. Maybe you can't Google experience, but you could learn that from that 50-year-old, and that 20-year-old might be able to teach that 50-year-old something new about the world. So we're just better off by reconnecting.
What's going on out there that's causing so much loneliness that you're talking about here?
It would be easy to just pinpoint one issue like social media, but as with everything else, there are positive benefits and there's a shadowy side to it. So I think that if we look at housing issues, for example, this model of a continuum of care for the elderly, strictly grown out of compassion, but many of those kinds of campuses are disconnected from neighborhoods. So housing is part of it. I think that disruption in the workplace is another significant factor. Today's disruptors may become tomorrow's disrupted. And I would also say that we have to look more carefully at the issue of social media, which can be a very critical factor for creating divisions where people retreat into their devices, or we use them as platforms for actually creating those connections.
You know, what's interesting to me about your book is, believe it or not, I've actually thought about this for a while, even before I saw your book, because maybe because I teach people, young folks up at UMKC, you know, this idea that people of different skin colors don't socialize together gets a lot of attention. But this idea that people of different ages don't socialize together all that much gets barely any. And I'm wondering, why is that?
I think that I think you've asked a really good question. And I think that it could be that we're not accustomed to having so many different generations alive at one time. When we spoke about in the 80s, the sandwich generation, typically that implied that there was a middle, right, that was really thinking of one generation above and one generation below. But I dedicated my book to one of my mentors. He was a kid when I interviewed him of 92 years old. Mm-hmm. He's a little bit older today. And to my granddaughter, who is 1 year old, think about that. That is a span of really almost a century now. So we don't have a playbook for really interacting organically with so many different generations, and it's off the radar scope.
Yeah. You know, I've worked in several different newsrooms over the years, and some of my older colleagues have often said to me, you know, they sort of grouse, you have the young people come in here, the interns come in here, they never stop and ask you what you do or if they can learn from your experience, and they're kind of put off by it.
I'm beginning to wonder whether or not this phenomenon of breaking news, news flashes, you know, has that affected our attention span? And are we so in the moment that we forget to take a look backwards? But there's a flip side to that, too. And very often, millennials believe that boomers really aren't listening to them, but lecturing them.
Yes. Let me get our listeners involved here. Do you agree that members of different generations don't spend much time together outside of family? And what's your theory as to why that is and what we can do about it? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. And you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, Chaim, you've said that we're living in one of the most age-segregated societies. And I'm wondering, you know, do other countries, are they really that different?
I think it depends upon culture and different parts of the world. You know, also geography plays a role. The United States is a very expansive country, and it's not unusual to have family members, friends scattered throughout not just the United States, but in other parts of the world. In other cultures where family connectedness is more valued, where there's more of a sense of a village mentality, where it isn't only members of families, but members of neighborhoods that have a caring for those in their environments, that makes a difference too. And I think we can begin to restore that somewhat here.
You know, from the people you talked to for this book, I got the clear impression that many of the older folks are frustrated by this separation from younger generations. I'm wondering, do you think the younger generations are as equally frustrated?
I haven't really heard that frustration as much from younger generations immediately, but then when I've had an opportunity to ask them about their life experiences and their formative experiences, often someone who's older, who's been a mentor, or an experience of working in Teach for America, AmeriCorps, Peace Corps, where they've had to intermingle with people of different generations, their eyes begin to sparkle a little bit, and they begin to realize, I only have friends now who are of my generation. And I think it is a provocative question for them.
I think it is, too. Again, going from personal experience here, sometimes when I bump into some of my own students on campus and you have a chance to walk with them for a little ways, you get almost the sense that they freeze up. They get so nervous about it. It's like, I've got to talk to this adult for a few minutes as we walk through campus, and it's going to be awkward and it's going to be torturous. It just almost, it's a visceral feeling you get.
It is, and it takes some practice because of the stereotypes that we have of one another. So one of the more engaging, personally for me, parts of researching this book is I asked millennials and boomers their respective perceptions of one another. So I asked millennials, when you hear the word boomer, what images come to mind? And I had to bite my tongue at times being a boomer. But what they said is boomers are not fun to be with. They only care about work. They are entitled just by dint of seniority and age, believe that they should lead. And then I ask boomers, when you hear the word millennials, what images or words come to mind? And pleasure seekers, apathetic,
yes.
snowflakes,
yes.
which I find very demeaning, you know, one of a kind. And interestingly, also using the word entitled, meaning you're, they believe that their employer should feel honored to have them as an employee.
Yes.
And by the way, when can I be CEO? But when you...
yes. yeah.
And the yes, I mean, stereotypes have some basis in reality, but I think if we can make just a little bit more time to move from the detriment of the doubt that somebody really doesn't care about me or what I have to say, to restoring the benefit of the doubt and move from being less judgmental to more curious, then maybe it's not so intimidating to have that conversation.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people, I think this goes for everybody, not just young folks or older folks, but this notion of having some natural curiosity about the person you're with and asking questions about their lives. I mean, that practice sort of seems to have gotten lost somewhere in recent decades. I don't know what your experience is, but I've noticed that.
I have too, and in writing the book, when I was speaking with a boomer, and I asked her, that very question, why do you think it is that people aren't really as curious as they used to be? And her response was, you know, how can people talk about things of substance when as soon as you mention that you've taken a vacation to a certain spot, they pull out their smartphone and want to show you their pictures of their vacation that they've been to. So I think there's something about needing to just slow it down a little bit and intentionally unplug. That is something that takes practice and discipline, and it's easier to do with a group.
Yeah. We have an email here from Laura who writes to say, hey, Gen X exists as well, which leads to a question I was going to ask you. In your book, you wound up focusing primarily on boomers and millennials, and you did so very intentionally. Why did you do that?
Well, first, it was a wise recommendation of my editor
yes.
who said, we don't want a book so long covering six generations, and it's also because those have been the two largest demographic cohorts. But I want to thank Laura for asking about Gen X, because I think that we've underestimated their ability to be the bridge spanners. They remember enough of a time when technology was not as pervasive or was just beginning to enter society.
Right.
But they've also had to migrate very quickly to technology. They're in leadership positions right now. I think they're an underutilized resource for helping to forge these intergenerational connections.
You know, a little while ago, Chaim, as you were talking about this, you mentioned these stereotypical images that boomers and millennials have of each other. Breaking those down, that is hard to do. How should we approach that difficult task?
What I found to be helpful is when somebody makes a remark about someone else that is offensive or off-putting, is not to respond reflexively with anger or with offense, but again, to open the conversation by asking, I'm curious what you mean by that. Can you tell me what caused you to think that way, and then to try to relate some sort of experience that other person has had where they felt, I guess, one who has been othered or stereotyped,
right,
and relate it back to the person that they've now stereotyped.
Mm-hmm. What got you thinking about all this, and what led to this book?
I began thinking about this back in the late 80s. And at one time, I was a congregational rabbi. Believe me, seminary education was wonderful. It actually had nothing to do with my practice in the congregation. Hmm. And nobody told me that I might be teaching preschool kids one moment and working with seniors around the book group and then with teenagers in the afternoon. Wow. So that really began to trigger this recognition on my part that to develop the vocabulary and the repertoire to be able to relate to people, not as a single cloth, but really as a patchwork that we are in communities, was something that was important. Fast forward now, a couple decades later, and I really feel a sense of legacy and believe that those of us who are in positions where we can let go and help reclaim conversation and empathy really have the task of doing that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about this idea that folks of different generations don't really talk to each other very much and why that is. My guest is Chaim Herring. He has a new book out called Connecting Generations, Bridging the Boomer, Gen X, and Millennial Divide. We've talked a little about social media and our phones and the impact those things have on everything these days. I'm wondering how much of this breakdown in communication between the different generations is due to the breakdown in major institutions. I'm thinking, I guess the first thing that comes to mind is mainline religion and churches and the practice of going to church on Sundays. It strikes me that that was a great opportunity for folks of different ages to come together, but those opportunities are a lot more limited these days.
They are, and even with all of their challenges today, faith communities, I think, are missing a very significant opportunity. They still function as multi-generational, yes, meaning that they have a number of different generations, but they're not acting intergenerationally. Just as an example, in a church, a synagogue, or mosque, there might be five different groups of different age cohorts working on issues of social justice or food security. What would happen? Why can't they get together and tackle the same kind of issue from an intergenerational perspective where everyone has an equal voice and an equal vote? I think a better solution would emerge.
You have some ideas for bringing people together, and one of them, Chaim, is make every third board member on committees be somebody under age 35. Why would that be important?
I find it fascinating that people who want to talk about the future don't fill committees with people, yes, who will be spending more time in, yes, the future than they will.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would love to see boards of civic organizations, nonprofits, really have at least a third of those who are under 35 and under.
Hmm. You also say this, take a risk. What do you mean by that, take a risk?
I think that we're so afraid that we might offend someone or startle someone whom we don't know very well. And I'll give you another personal example. About a half a year before the 2016 presidential elections, I decided that instead of just walking by people in my office, kind of mumbling hello,
right,
that I would stop and say, you know, I don't want to just mumble hello anymore. I don't know your name. I'd like to know that so I can greet you by name. And simple practices like that. And I heard this from boomers. What was so encouraging was I heard this from millennials who said, take a risk to enter a conversation with someone who is older.
Hmm. And it worked. What changes did you see as a result of all that?
Well, the good news is it doesn't take an act of Congress to say hello to someone. And suddenly, I'm meeting some people who are fascinating. I don't agree with them. I'm not out to persuade them of what I believe. They're not out to persuade me of what they believe. We know that we're different, but we value the fact that we now actually have some friendships that we wouldn't have had otherwise.
Hmm. You mentioned, going back to this idea of stereotypes, one of the big differences between boomers and millennials is this concept of what you call pathways and ladders. Explain that one to us.
Yes. So millennials are justifiably frustrated when a boomer says to him or her, "So what would you like to do 10 years from now or for the rest of your life?" And they're frustrated because how can they answer that question when the job that they have 3 years from now may not exist today?
Right.
For
right.
boomers, it was pretty clear cut. There were milestones of achievement, much more of a linear path upward. But when things are evolving so rapidly, why should a millennial have to commit and know what it is that they're going to be doing? That can become a source of tension or, again, an opening for a conversation about what's different today.
I was going to say, because both these groups look at the future in such different ways because of their experiences. I mean, boomers got a job and sort of stayed with the company forever. Millennials are looking at this in a completely different way.
Well, The Organization Man, even though that book came out in 1956, I think it pretty much captured this notion of becoming subservient to the organization. And in return, the company gave you certain more or less guaranteed perks.
Right.
But for millennials today who are coming out of college with heavy loads of debt, with job insecurity, working in a gig economy, and also wanting to be creative and inventive, their road into adulthood will be more like networks and pathways as opposed to these ladders that are very linear.
You also found a key difference in the way that millennials and boomers value the idea of community. How so?
One of the questions, which is very much, I think, up for discussion, it's fluid and we're learning. There was general agreement across the board that being a part of some kind of community was important.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where differences broke down, and not always by age, did community mean FaceTime or face-to-face time? Being in the same room with someone.
Mm-hmm.
Did it mean that if you had a long-standing friendship with someone, it wasn't important to be in contact with that person on a regular basis? You had a history, picked up the phone, texted, and resumed where you left off? Or did it mean intentionally remaining close because of that history? So
right.
Community is up for grabs, and I'm going to throw one more out that I did
Dude,
not
I got about
10
seconds in. Left time.
Sure. What happens when we go to a screenless society and we're interacting with holograms?
Oh, there you go. There you go. There's tomorrow's thought question for Monday's show. That's Chaim Herring, his new book, Connecting Generations, Bridging the Boomer, Gen X, and Millennial Divide. Thanks so much for a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next week on the show, two young people's journey through America's criminal justice system and what it says about the power of prosecutors. We'll also learn why KCMO is taking over trash collection citywide. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Brian Ellison, Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.